All right, I'm happy to see everyone. First of all, today we're rolling, everything is on. Thank you, thank you. I was with my own grandchildren, a medical doctor. I told him I have a student, a medical doctor, Baruch Hashem. Second to being a Rebbe, there's nothing more important than being a medical doctor. I mean, daf sein a mensch, you have to understand it's gemilut chesed, and you're the shliach of Hashem, v'po yirapeh. Third in line is a nurse. A nurse may be above everyone because her whole profession is gemilut chesed. All right, today, thank God I can teach normally and speak to my class, not to strangers. Today is the 19th of February, 2018, Monday morning here in Yerushalayim. Regarding a topic that we raised on Reb Aaron Cutler and Chabad, I just gave Haskamah, it's on Sherry's desk. I have a few corrections and we'll send it out today. A new volume is coming out by Chaim Dolfin, Rabbi Dolfin, this Chabadnik who wrote many books, but particularly we cited in class the book he wrote on Shlomo LeKalbach, which is a fascinating volume because he actually interviewed women, something that Offenbacher Rofia did not do. And he wrote on the Raven that I believe we've spoken about that many times. Now he wrote on Lakewood and Chabad, Lakewood and Lubavitch. It'll be a while till the book is out. I went through it in a more primitive state. In the book, he quotes Jacob Zakheim, but he gives the years, he passed this back as 1910 to 2009, so that should be corrected. Okay. And he quotes Jacobs, I'll tell you in my office, I'll give you the email to, and he deals with the topic we have raised, a very delicate topic, and according to the evidence and the documents he cites, it's a very depressing conclusion. That money was ordered give to the Mira, but not to give to Chabad. And ultimately, three Chabadikim died in Shanghai, one of them from malnutrition, starvation. The other two, they say, had they had a more normal diet, they would have survived the illnesses. So a very, very sad conclusion. And he seems to make that conclusion. The documents seem to indicate it, which shows us we should not... We have our own opinions. I just wrote to someone else. I got a letter why I'm opposed to computers. It ruins lives. Cars, it's only accidents that kill 30 million people. So I wrote back, I never argue with someone on Hashkafa. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. He asked me another question that I thought I answered. But it's sad. Okay. I want to dedicate, unfortunately, at our age, most of us are a little bit older than you, doctor. At our age, unfortunately, there's so many Modot Evel, and a person died who was a key player on the American Torah scene. How many of you recall the name? Rabbi Dr. Gilbert Klapperman. And Gil Klapperman, he built today, who could dream what would become in Lawrence? He built an Orthodox shul there. Charlie, do you realize that shul began semi-conservative? You follow it today? You think of Lawrence, the mechitza isn't big enough, right or wrong? That's the initial reaction when you walk into Bet Shalom, unless they changed it, I don't know. But he built it from the ground. And he said something, he was my teacher in college, Jewish sociology. He had a doctorate from Bernard Rebel. He actually wrote the book before mine. His book is on the early history of the yeshiva. I quoted it 5-6 years ago in great detail. My work follows on Rabbi Rebel. But Gil Klapperman was a Talmud of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik yet. And he said something that I'll never forget. I felt it to my grandchildren a number of times. I quote him now. He said he came home for... The vacation, Pesach time, and his father comes over to him. His father was a sheikher, if I'm not mistaken, in the Midwest. And, you know, all the shechita was in the Midwest, even until today. And his father comes over to him and says, Gedalia, has du gedavent mincha shein? Did you daven mincha? And he says to his father, Tata, and I'll say it in English, of course the conversation was in Yiddish, he says to his father, Father, I'm learning by Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. I'm going to get smicha in a year or two. And you're worried that I shouldn't daven mincha? And his father said, Was kann ich tun? Ich bin ein Tata. And a father has to worry. He has to ask. That's a beautiful thought. Think about it. So I want to dedicate today's shiur to Rabbi Dr. Gilbert Klapperman, a wonderful, wonderful individual. His first wife, Libby, wrote Jewish history books. If you recall, when I ran Talmud Torahs in my shul, and even when I taught my first 2 years, 1 year before I got married, the year after I got married, then I got smicha. So that was the Jewish history book we used by Libby Klapperman. I don't know, she was excellent. She died young, and he remarried Bezivik Sheni, a very famous woman. Susan Alter was a state assemblywoman. You see from the name Alter, Yichis from the Gera Rebbe, the Gera dynasty originally is Rothenberg, but for whatever the reasons, the name changed to Alter, A-L-T-E-R. If you meet anyone named Alter, you know they're definitely related to Gera. If you meet anyone named Hager, H-A-G-E-R, who are they related to? Vishnitz. You follow? The multimillionaire out on the coast who does so much for Torah in Israel, and he's a very enlightened Haredi individual, Hager. He's a cousin to the Vishnitz Rebbe. Some comments on previous lectures, very interesting comments. Dr. William Gewirtz writes back something very fascinating about Professor Lieberman. Remember we spoke about the Rav and Professor Lieberman, that the Rav was always surrounded by Talmidim. But Professor Lieberman, back to the library, back to research. He said absolutely correct, but the few that got to know Professor Lieberman were the ones who did a doctorate under him. And they worked with him, you know, beyond classroom hours. And the Haraya, I wrote back to him, I'll give you a simple example. I trust you recognize the name, Rabbi Dr. Dov Zlotnik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Dov Zlotnik became his son. The Liebmans had no children. And the executor who took care of his will and his possessions was Dov Zlotnik. And Dov Zlotnik really, he lived Professor Lieberman like I lived the Rav 24/7. He lived Professor Shaul Lieberman 24/7. He was a very wonderful individual. He died a few years ago. I davened with him for many, many years. The same minyan we sat. He knew Shisha Sidre Mishnah by heart. Dov Zlotnik. That was his doctorate. He worked on the text of Mishnah. Very interesting comment, and I totally agree. Rabbi Sion Levy, who we mentioned in class, in the Sunday class with the Shelet and Shuvet, and I got all excited. So, it's really the Neshamayim that Avi Schwartz should be sitting here on the Sunday. He comes to the Sunday class, and this Sion Levy was from Sada Kedushin for his grandparents and his parents. So I mentioned that YU once went crazy with joy. Yeshiva College was towards the end of Rabbi Rebbe's life. Sion Levy came to study there, and the publicity, you know, fundraising. It's like I asked now, how come I'm speaking at these locations, at these shuls? And the answer was, these are shuls that YU does heavy fundraising in. The people there can give. So YU got all excited to a publicity. It must be 39-40. I didn't want to spend time going through my archives, but I'm sure I have it in my archives. So maybe it's the same Sion Levy. I'm at a dead end. Why? I read through the article that he sent me, but it's from the Haredi world. And the Haredi world, you see, they don't mention a word that he studied for a while at Dreetz. The chances are it's exactly this Sion Levy. I cannot uncover anyone else. I went online. So if anyone knows, if anyone can help me, please respond. But I think it's one and the same person. Another comment I made, I just want to clarify, Ira Wishnitzer, my dear student from Chicago, I mentioned in passing the Lubavitcher Rebbe didn't get involved in Shidduch. I mentioned it just so he wrote to me, you know, that. No, what I meant was the Lubavitcher Rebbe never suggested Shidduchim. He, of course, people came to him, Rebbe, want to get married, this is my kala. It's true that the people came to him, is this woman pasik for me, I don't know, I forget my English already, is this woman fitting for me? And the Rebbe, 90% of the time, 99% said yes. Once in a while he said no. On that level he was a Rebbe. But to get involved in making shidduchim, this I know from Tzvi Groner, time and again I would come up with ideas and Tzvi said, the Rebbe doesn't get involved, my cousin doesn't get involved. Same thing with Gittin. I had a Talmud who became a Lubavitcher and overly bright. Sometimes, you know the expression, an Ibbur Chacham, overly bright, till he got married and what kind of, and finally the divorce, so she wanted a divorce, so he wanted to talk with the Rebbe, to talk with her, and the Rebbe said that he doesn't get involved with the family problems, which I understand because England of herself. All right, one final comment where I'm very interesting. I'm very proud of what I said on the that letter of the Rav to Miriam Shiloh. That's a moment in time. The world doesn't realize what an important letter and how Miriam Upgeteicht, how we interpreted the final paragraph. That's my own, and I think I'm right. Again, when you come up with a chiddush, you come up with insight, you never want to say you're totally right, but I'm willing to say I'm 90% right. But that Miriam Shiloh, Zichrono Tzadeket Levracha, look what a schut she had, that she wrote to the Rav and she engendered such a response. So I take a look in the freebies, Gilui Dat of last week, I believe this is, Echad al Echad. They interview someone, many questions. Old Orech Din Yifa Segel, and she's against the boycott. They're interviewing her, what she does. She fights BDS, and she begins, Sapel Atzmeich, tell us about you. Ani Hasheni B'Shiva Yiladehem Shel Rav Daniel U'Miriam Shila. This has to be her daughter. So it was very moving to me to read the article and see that there's continuity because Miriam Shiloh died young. All right, let's roll. All right, today is very fascinating, she heard it, you'll see. So the Agudat HaRabbanim is established, and really when you go through the initial years of the Agudat HaRabbanim, you're treading water. The problems are basically the same. And look at it, just think for a minute. You're a Yudapayish Rav, a Talmud Chacham, you're coming to America, you never learn English. You got to remember that the Rav in America was much more comfortable in his study with his Sfarim. He wasn't out in the world, he depended upon his wife. There was no concept of separate seating at weddings. The Rabbanim used to sit with their wives. These wives were there. Without them, they couldn't exist. The Freien haben gerät, a bissel English. They knew how to go into a store. They knew how to shop. They knew how to use the bus. I mean, just think when you're a newcomer, when you come in Aliyah, and this is a country of Olim, where the country, I spoke about it yesterday. I spoke about it in 69. There were signs up all over. One sign was Kol HaKavod LeTzahal, right after the Six-Day War, all over Kol HaKavod LeTzahal. The other sign was there's now an upsurge in Aliyah, so they want to prepare the people. Me'olel Oleh, Kochenu Oleh. Our strength goes up. And all the cynics used to say, Me'olel Oleh, Misinu Oleh. Our taxes go up. So, you know, it's a struggle. And here, this is a country geared at least to try to help you. I remember when I became a citizen, in those days, the first 3 years, you were Toshav Arai. And then at the end of 3 years, you could choose to become a Toshav Kavua or a citizen. You don't have this anymore. It's very different. So when we became a citizen, Malk and I at the Mizrat HaPnim, and we changed our names, you know, everything that goes with it legally, because we were using our kefir already, but now it's legal. And the guy sitting behind the desk from underneath pulls out a bottle of brandy. From the drawer, he pulls out lekach, and he makes a l'chaim with you that you became a citizen. So in this country, but in the United States, I don't believe anyone made a l'chaim and anyone was happy. And these Rabbanim are treading water, that they're dreaming about the language, what language to teach. They're trying to fight JTS. They're taking over, they're daydreaming, we got to build the reefs that will succeed. All these beautiful plans, all these difficulties, the Chilul Shabbos, the Mohalim who canceled the Brit. Could you imagine the Mohel yesterday? I would say to him, "No, are you happy the Brit is on Sunday? At least we can pay you." And it doesn't, these concepts don't exist today. You should have seen this Mohel, a Svadik Mohel, this Petach Tikva, a new era. This is Irganim, I think it's called. It didn't exist. My son-in-law grew up in Petach Tikva. This whole area today, buildings 20 stories high, 18 stories high. Everyone from basically Kippat Srugat, but Haredim, Hasidim, shuls, every corner. The shul, I was brand new, tremendous. Maybe it could sit 600-700 people. I couldn't believe the size. It was one of many shul. And the mall, he was singing and he had everyone dancing. I couldn't believe it. A Hesda graduate. Ah, so imagine you're fighting Mohalim. Everything should be on Sunday because on Sunday they get paid. Ah, what's going on, and all these conventions and all these plans and all these resolutions. And finally you come to 1912. This is right before World War I. And this is the first convention where they're really tackling problems. What has happened? What has happened? What is different? What has happened? And one name comes on the agenda, Reb Lazer Silva. From 1912, for the rest of the history of Agudas HaRabbanim, no name is more important than Reb Lazer Silva. And this is the same Reb Lazer Silva who gets up at the convention, and this is in print. Following, not gossip. He gets up at the convention, and from the protocol, they wrote this book, and he says, "In bis jetzt hat der Agudas Rabbanim nicht gar nicht getan. Until now, the Agudas Rabbanim accomplished absolutely nothing." Got up and said it. Where was he different? And here I'll let you in on the secret. And again, I repeat the story I've told so many times, but I repeat it now in a different context. When the Rav comes to America, Rav Moshe carried on, mein Zunder Gon, and he's saying over Torah from his son. No, the Rav arrives, gets off the boat, comes to Washington Heights with his wife and little girl, Atara, parents' apartment, students see him, clean shaven, PhD from Berlin, and Midlach Sechois from him. They're laughing, Reb Moshe, you know, you boast about your son. Some people, my son the doctor, my son the rabbi, my son this, my son that. Today you would boast about your daughter. I got to be careful what I say. The men and women are equal out there in the world. I have a lot to say. I'm going to speak at Stern College. I'm going to go right into the lion's den and open my mouth. I won't have too many detractors, but we'll do what we can. I once heard a voice from the Chama Leibowitz, Eishet Chayu Miyimsa, who wants a woman like that? She overworks. She does too much. The man is sitting with the elders at Tutganish, right or wrong. He sits and learns, talks different Torah and Narishkeit, and the wife is out there, the house, the home, everything. So here's the Rav. You know, you're boasting about your son. So now the Rav gives his first shiur to the Agudas HaRabbanim. And Rav Moshe tells him before the shiur, "Remember what I told you?" Rav Moshe says, "I heard this from the Rav with these ears. I heard it a number of times." Rav Moshe says, I'm living it in Yiddish. I'll try to say it in English. "You'll come into the room. You'll see a lot of rabbis sitting there mit kleider, rabbinische kleider, with rabbinic clothes. Ach, I mean, cooked ice with lange bod, big beards, they look like rabbis. You should know, if they wouldn't have good memories, they wouldn't know a thing. They haven't opened a Gemara since they arrived in America. All they know is what they learned in Europe. But Moshe says to us, da'ena, a kleina, that sits in Dutton with that cylinder. You'll see a short guy sitting with a cylinder, I don't know how to say it in English, a high hat. And from Em Hat Meira, as it's been led in Yom Valayla, he learns day and night. Be afraid of him. And the Rav Taka said, I finished the shiur. It was in Ankadshim, on Avodis Yom HaKippurim. It was right before Yom Kippur when he arrived. He finished the shiur, and he says, everyone gave him a big yashikaya. And he says, the guy with the cylinder comes over to him, shakes his hand, and he feels something moving into his hand. A shtickle papir, a piece of paper, he puts it in his pocket. The Rav said, well, I got back to the apartment, I took a look, he asked me seven fantastic questions, and what I said. Now, what was the secret of Blazer? And here, I'll give it to you. Everyone else we speak about was a Yudapayish Rav, was raised in Europe, his whole mentality was formed in Europe, he learned in Europe, his knowledge was from Europe. All right, he happened to wander into America. You follow me, Harold? He wandered in. Whether he wanted, didn't want, but he wandered in. Okay? Reb Lazer, first of all, came to America. He didn't wander. He's running away from Europe. He was fed up with the narrow-mindedness in Europe. I told you, he married a girl that he fell in love with on his own. He went into the Strashun Library in Vilna, which Hitler destroyed. It was the biggest rabbinic library in all of Europe. And there was a girl working there. They tell me she was a beauty. I never met her. She died young. Four children and then died young. They say every her children, a member of David Silverman, said my mother was a beauty, a beauty. Oh, he fell in love with her. Thank God. A man has to feel his wife is a beauty 100%. So he married her. So everyone was murmuring, what, the Dushtat, the Rav's son, without a shidduch, right or wrong? What the heck with you? He had relatives in America. And you know, he's a youngster. And he went to America. I'll give you his years, Reb Lazer. So it was 1882 to 1968. 1982-1968. So he goes to America. You read my book, you get all the details. But approximately 1907 comes to America, and he's sick and tired of the rabbinate. He wants to make a living. I think he starts selling insurance. He's learning English. So they tell him, look, you belong in the rabbinate. Don't get involved with insurance. There was a shteller in Harrisburg, and he went to Harrisburg. In Harrisburg, he learned day and night. He is the first Yudapayish Rav who became a gadol b'Torah on American soil. Do you understand what I'm saying? Harrisburg was a little shteller. Rabbi Yitzchak Chanan used to cry why he left Nevada. He said, had I remained, he was succeeded by the Aruch HaShulchan. He says, if I had remained in Nevada, I could have written as many Sfarim as the Aruch HaShulchan wrote. But I was foolish enough to go to Kovna, which was the biggest, most important rabbinate in the literature world in Eastern Europe. And in Kovna, they bothered him day and night, you understand? This was like everyone looks to come to New York. Show me one rabbi in New York who can sit and learn. But you go to Kalamazoo, Michigan, fine, you can't make the same living, you can't feel the same success, but no one is going to bother you sitting and learning. Reb Lazer Silver came to America in Eloy. In America, he became a gong. That's the difference. He was the first one, very unique in that respect. This is why the Rav looked up to him. This was the Rav's model from the day he arrived in America until Baruch Hashem, the day that he wound up in a little classroom in Washington Heights and started giving a shiur May of 1941. The first shiur was on a subject in Baba Batra, Otiyot Niknot B'Mesira. He didn't pronounce it that way, but it taught me to speak Ashkenazis now. But he looked up to Rablaisa. This was the secret of Rablaisa Silva. He was different. I can't say he became an American rabbi in the sense that he spoke beautiful English and was totally at home and was a college graduate, but in this respect, this was Rablaisa. He put the Agudat HaRabbanim on the map. And I can give you a simple analogy. By the way, he did speak a very passable English. Don't misunderstand me. I met Rablaisa Silva twice in my life. Two very fascinating stories. I tell them in the Silva era. First time I met him was in the Rabbinate, 1961. Kid of 23. Leave New York. Head to the wilderness of Philadelphia. Imagine if someone would have tapped me on the shoulder and said, Arnie, don't worry, in 60, 70 years from now, why you is going to invite you, Bukovic Gadol, to come back and speak, the featured speak on the Rav's 25th Yahrzeit. Life would have been a lot easier had I had that promise. You follow me, Charlie? But it doesn't work that way. If it worked that way, there'd be no joy to life, no struggle, no achievement. Anyway, I come to the big city. Every word I'm telling you is true. And Cholamoed Pesach, Cholamoed Sukkot, my first Sukkot, 1961, September, October. They interrupt the news. I'm listening to the news. The chief rabbi of Philadelphia has just died. I later learned that three other individuals almost had heart failure when they heard the news, because there were four people who claimed they were chief rabbi of Philadelphia, and I can actually give you all their names. But the Rablaisa Rav, Rablaisa Pupko, died. Ah, now began a big machloket, who will take over the Schlachthaus? He was in the slaughterhouse. So the machloket begins, it's an endless machloket. Dov, your father was in the rabbinate. I don't have to detail when the rabbis fight, money's involved. I get a call, as long as I live, I can't forget it. Don't want to mention the name, but some part of the family, Rabbi Rotkoff, I have a hashgacha for you, a bakery, Machalos Shabbos. I say, how can I give a hashgacha to Chilul Shabbos? I said, why are you leaving? Well, it could be I'll go into the Schlachthaus. I don't want people to say, so if you can't, how can I? And I turned him down. He says to me, Vasi, what is with you, Rabbi Rothkopf? You don't want to be rich? That was my introduction to the American rabbinate, Allah Agudas HaRabbanim. So now the Rabbanim, we have a big meeting. I mean, I'm a kid. I don't say a word. I don't know what's going on. I don't know who am I to say a word, but I'm a rabbi. I'm a member of the rabbinate there. So they decide they're bringing in Rablaisa Silva to decide who will go into the Schlachthaus. And everyone signs, myself included, that we will accept. He's a Bore Yachid. You understand what I'm saying? Halachic terminology. Kol echad zabla. Zebarala. He's a Bore Yachid. Everyone will accept what he is going to say. All right? Few days later, this is all by telegrams. This is before emails and faxes. Telegrams. Few days later, the whole rabbinate is at Pennsylvania Station, downtown Philadelphia. Rablaisa Silver's coming in. And a big crowd surges forward. I mean, I was standing in back. Who am I? And I think it's Michelle. I see this little guy. And everyone is inviting him. With my own ears, I heard, Kum bamir, chad bamir, I have plenty of room in my house. They come. He says, name, chtab gebin a psak. If I go to someone's house, it's shaychad. The prime minister should be hearing this Shia. If I go to someone's house, it's shaychad. You follow? He wouldn't go. Abu is the Nenta Hotel. Where's the closest hotel? That's where I'll stay. And sure enough, he stayed in the hotel and he gave a psak. That was my first meeting with him. Now, about 7 years later, let's say, I was already a Rosh Yeshiva. Charlie knew me, Rabbi Rothkopf in the yeshiva. So there was an affair by the alumni of Lamsha Yeshiva. and they're making an affair, and they're honoring Mr. Norman B. Abrams. Charlie, why are they honoring Mr. Norman B. Abrams? I'll tell you the secret. Norman B. Abrams, where does he come to Lumsha Yeshiva? Did they remember him? Not Lumsha. His father was the Mashgiach Rav Avram Pachta in Lumsha Yeshiva. When he came to America, his name was, he went to TI, he went to YU. His name was Pachta. People laughed at the name. So he changed it in honor of his father, Abrams. Abraham, the son of Abraham. That's how he got to be Norman. His father was Lumsha Mashgiach. They're honoring him. Now, who are the speakers? They want to attract the modern Orthodox, I'm using contemporary terms, and the old-fashioned Orthodox, the Haredim. So they have two speakers, Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Rackman and Reb Lazer Silva. And the whole REITS faculty, our guests, were all there. I mean, some people brought Balabata, I might have brought a Balabasa too. All right, beautiful affair on the Upper West Side. It may have been in the Riverside Plaza. I don't recall exactly, but it may have been in the Riverside Plaza because that was the in-place for Orthodox affairs. It doesn't, today Riverside Plaza, I think it's a drug addict center, a halfway house or something. But the Riverside, Vic, you remember the Riverside Plaza? You played there? You made a living there? Okay, good. It's a drummer. You played there. Okay. Now, Emanuel Rackman speaks, brilliant speaker. No Yitz, what language did he speak?
English.
Reb Lazer Silva gets up to speak. I'm giving it to you word by word. Et mein guter Freund, Rav Rackman, as wun von mein teure Chaver, Reb David Rackman, can I say reden in a goyische Sprache? Can I reden? If my dear friend Rabbi Emanuel Rackman, the son of Rabbi David Rackman, the rabbi, he was a member of the Rabbanim, this was my good. If he can speak English, I can speak English. And I got to tell you, for 25 minutes, he gave a pupil in English. At the very end, he couldn't control. He was reaching a crescendo. He broke into Yiddish. But 25 minutes English, and you could follow him. So, see, I can't say Reb Lazer spoke English like Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. All right? I don't want to. He didn't speak English like the Rav, but he had a passable English. This man later becomes good friends, as you know, with President Taft, with Taft's son, with the senator. The man could move mountains. He had a passable English. He now becomes the dominant personality in the Agudas HaRabbanim. From 1912 on, he's chairman of the board, ultimately president, and when they have tremendous machloket and they can't solve it, so they hit upon a fabulous idea, a presidium. Whenever you hear a presidium, it means the machlokes are so great, there's no solution, so they make all of them presidents. Let them kill each other and have the title president and the cover. There was never a moment in time till the day of his death, and we'll see. It's very fascinating what happens. And I'll give you an example of someone else who accomplished on the American scene wonders. Someone I knew quite well. Knew the name Morris Scherer, Moshe Scherer, mean anything to you? Agudas Yisrael owns America today. Beyond words. There are reasons why. Mizrahi, anyone who took the Mizrahi message seriously is living in Israel. A lady came over to me yesterday at the Brit. Her son married my granddaughter-in-law's brother. Beautiful B'nai Terah. An American lady, an American family came and I lived in Beit Shemesh. And she said to me, remember I called you years ago, she said, I read your book, Washington, why don't the Americans come in Aliyah? Years ago, and I told her, you know, you can't shake them up. We get Trumit and Maisra, we get the best, but we get a small percentage. And the Mizrahi, it's a who's who in America and then in Israel of people who came. So the organization, ultimately, who's left there? Who's left there? Aguda wouldn't have conquered the world. They were Yehuda Paisha. But Moshe Shera, this was an American kid, like ice cream, like cherry pie, like blueberry pie. This was an American kid, born in Brooklyn, went to Torah Vadas, went to Ne Yisrael, grew up, ability, put the Agudat Yisrael on the map. You don't know, but there were big attempts made to bring the whole machlokes from Israel between the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim. You remember what went on here in the 1980s. And Rashi Yeshiva in America, one in particular, wanted to bring that whole machlokes to America. Maris Sherer single-handedly forestalled it, canceled it, solved every problem with Seichel. He knew the American scene. Then you have the Hasidic world. Then you have conventions. No, men and women sitting together. Why, it's an open Mishnah. Men, you have to sit with your wife Friday night, Shabbos, you have to eat with her, an open Mishnah in Ketuvot. And what? Men and women sitting together. Oy vey! No, how do you solve the problem? This was Maris Shera. When you registered for an Aguda convention, they asked you, family seating or separate seating? So all the Gerach Hasidim could sit separate like they do at home, and all the other Jews, Litvisher and the non-Gerach, you could sit with your family. This was Maris Shera. Try to understand Reb Lazer Silva, that this was similar what Reb Moshe Shera did for Agudat Yisrael, Reb Lazer Silva did for the Agudat HaRabbanim. He put it on the map in the full sense of the word. Now, let's now become a little bit broader. Agudat now, these Americans, Reb Lazer Silva, generation shifting. More Rabbanim are living in America. More Rabbanim are living in America 10, 20, 30, 40 years. Willy-nilly, you have to pick up a little of the mentality. People living here, my mother lived here many, many years. She picked up some basic Hebrew. She didn't need it. Everyone speaks English. Yerushalayim, you can live all your life speaking English or speaking French. I remember coming in Aliyah in Rehavia, all you heard in the street was German. It was the old-time Yekkes. But willy-nilly, you can't help it. You're living in a country. You have to pick up something. The Agudas HaRabbanim now starts getting involved in worldwide problems. The Bilas trial. They opened their mouths loud and clear. Etrogim. Remember, this is an issue that hangs fire until today, although it's a small fire. What do you prefer? An etrog from someplace in Italy, Greece, Morocco, or an etrog from Eretz Yisrael? The whole problem of murkhazim, harkava, hybrids. Does anyone here, can we be absolutely sure the etrog we have is a proper etrog and hasn't been what would be the word, Yomo? Grafted with some other fruit to make it stronger, to help it grow better, to help it grow easier. No, from Morocco we have a tradition that the Agudat HaRabbanim came out very strongly only to use Israeli etrogim and to depend upon the heksha that is given there. Now they start to have a worldwide view. And then they start to understand America a little better. You find already in the pre-World War I era, right before World War I, the Agudas HaRabbanim starts talking about the rabbis need a pension plan. You take for granted today, when you take a job, it's not so much the salary that interests you, but the benefits. I can tell you, I still remember in my youth, when a rabbi died, people used to make a collection to help the widow. There was nothing whatsoever that was saved. There was no obligation. There was no pension plan. I still remember Yeshiva University when I already was a Rebbe. This had to be around 60. I started teaching in YU in 62. This had to be about 64. There was big, tremendous news. YU is instituting a pension plan for its faculty. And you don't realize, this was epic making. Mr. Joe Gruss, wonderful, we're sitting here because of him. When he got involved with Yiddishkeit and the Rav read him the Riot Act that he didn't send his own children to day school, Mr. Gruss got involved, and he once said to me, the future of our people, Zayn de Kinderlach mit de Preislach. He understood already, the kids with the Preis, this is our future. No, he went to Brooklyn, he went to all the schools, Chassidish Yeshiva, no pension plan. Mr. Gruss introduced, put hundreds of millions of dollars, by today's standards, probably billions of dollars, into pension plans in every yeshiva in the greater New York area. That was all Mr. Gruss. You go to Brooklyn, you'll see his name all over. Caroline and Joseph Gruss. There it's Joseph and Caroline Gruss. For me, it has to be Caroline, the Talmud of the Rav. Caroline and Joseph Gruss. But you see, the Buddhist from the Rabbanim here, they're becoming quite wise. They're becoming Americanized. They're starting to understand what America is about, what life is about, what Panasa is about, what the Jewish world is about. And you start to see in the subsequent conventions, 1913, 1912, 1913, you see already they're concerned with the real Torah on the American scene, with real issues. They're no longer dreaming about problems that exist that they'll never be able to help. They have become realists. And then the world changes. And we've come to the heart of today's shiur. It's the heart of modern Jewish history, basically. The world changes. It sounds foolish for us today to comprehend what happened 100 years ago. Today we've been through so many wars and so much torture and the Hitler era. It's hard to believe, but 1914, when World War I broke out, everyone thought that would be the war to end all wars. What was it called? The Great War, remember? The war to end all wars, the Great War, the amount of life lost, the millions and millions. It was the last war fought, soldier against soldier. They would fight. It's beyond words. Christian versus Christian. Christmas, they would call a truce, and they would play a game of soccer, Germans against French, etc. And the next day, they'd be killing each other all over again. And they would move forward 10 foot. 1,000 soldiers fell. The next day, move back 10 feet. Another 1,000. It's just beyond words, the loss of life and what it did for the Jewish people, and I've told you more than once, I've written about it, and Chaim Sabato has his story about it. I'm only sitting here because of one little incident that happened in World War I. No, do you remember? I came into class right before the 44, everyone was talking Normandy, where are they going to land, where are they going to land? It was a big secret. I still remember my father listening to WOR, with the maps in front of him, and D-Day. So we come into class, Yeshiva Solanta, Webster Avenue in the Bronx, the only day school in all of the Bronx, a school that began in Harlem right after my father was too old already. It began a year or two. Imagine had my father gone to Harlem, it would have been a different story. Had gone to Solanta, it would have been a different story, but it didn't exist when he was ready for school. It was a year or two later. And we had this teacher, Mr. Markowitz. Very interesting individual. And Mr. Markowitz looks at the class. I'm trying to recall if he spoke Hebrew to us or Yiddish. I think it was Hebrew. And he says, "Yeah, you atem choshvim shani adam zakein, ani lo yodei maset sava. Ani lachamti b'milchama rishona. And he says, Ani asapel lachem sipur. And then he told us the story that changed my life. And it changed Chaim Sabato's life. Had the same story. And read his one, his next to latest book. And he was a Russian soldier on the front line with another Jewish boy. They're shooting at the Germans. And his friend scores a direct hit. And the German drops his gun. And with his last strength shouts, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And his friend committed suicide 2 days later in a Russian field hospital that he had killed the Jew. All right? And this was World War One. So World War One, first of all, you have to understand, it created the Zionist movement. Before World War One, any Jew who said he was a Zionist was looked down upon by his friends, his neighbors, by the people in shul. What are you, a moron? What's wrong with America? Look at the Chafetz Chaim, Nidche Yisrael. I translate part of it in the Silver Era. What's wrong with Europe? The only place in the world, the Chafetz Chaim says, if you want your kids to be good Jews, come back to Lithuania, come back to Russia, come back to Poland, come back to the Ukraine. Here we can raise our children to be good Jews. In two World War One, the Zionists were few and far between. Yes, there was Bilo, there were some settlements, but it never was a massive movement. After World War One, Zionism conquered the world. The greatest miracle that the Jews have achieved since Churban Bayit, the Zionist movement. And the reason was very simple, because in World War One, you saw the Jew was nothing. If he fought, he killed fellow Jews. If he didn't fight, he was overrun by the armies fighting each other. And whenever you had the people went on a spree to kill, they killed the Jews, pogrom after pogrom. What happened in World War One was an overture to World War II, but no one could ever believe there could be a worse war, a worse situation than World War One. So number one, World War One created the Zionist movement, which in turn creates the Mizrahi movement. It gives birth to endless aspirations and dreams and Rabbanim, and ultimately the Rav's Goldo Dido fake goes back to World War One. But as far as the Ezgudas Rabbanim was concerned, and the American Jew, World War One declared to the American Jew, you are the center of the Jewish world. You have a responsibility that goes way beyond your little community. Before World War One, this message could never have taken hold. By World War One, Gitten V'yotten Boin Kiyachot, if I can paraphrase the Gemara, the Rabbanim are more Americanized. Reb Lezer Silva can talk to the President of the United States in English and make a deep impression. More and more Rabbanim are more cultured to the American scene. Some of them actually don't have to be led by their wives to master the area in which they live. This is one part of the puzzle. The other part, we are our brother's keepers. They started to realize, thank God in America, we have money. We make a living. We have freedom. And this went right down the line. Originally, you had the wealthy German families following the Civil War. All of American mercantile history, Jews, Macy's, Klein's, Gimbel's, Bambergers, Saks Fifth Avenue. Just think for a minute what we're talking about. After World War One, the East European Jews, it's now a second generation. Some of them are really succeeding. They're acculturated. They're Americans. They appreciate the freedom. My own family, I told you, my grandfather, my mother's father, who had learned in the Lashon in his youth, remembered Gemaras by heart many decades later. He was a contractor painter, functioned out of Williamsburg. He would give the American government a gift when he paid taxes, so for the sake of argument, he owed $500 at the end of the year. He would add $50 as a voluntary gift to the United States government. He came from Europe, and here he's free. Freedom accepted. The American Jew had a different conscience, a different self-esteem. And even the East European, he wasn't here as long as the Spanish Portuguese. He wasn't here as long as the Germans. Perhaps he wasn't as wealthy. But East Europeans now had multi-millionaires, self-made. Give a name, Harry Fisher, Mendel Gottesman, Nathan Lamport. Is there any person who went to IU who hasn't heard of these names? Joseph, you've heard these names? Nothing new? You didn't have to go back to my lectures 6, 7 years ago? Okay, Baruch Hashem. Harry Fisher, classic example. He left a biography, you can call it an autobiography. His son-in-law signed on it, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein. But most of that autobiography/autobiography was dictated by his father-in-law. And Harry Fischel describes how when he arrives in America, what was it, Battery Park? And he's met by cousins. And they see he's still wearing a kippah. They tell him, throw the kippah away. That's left on the other side of the ocean. And he describes how he loses his job. He won't work Shabbos. He's starving. And he finally decides he has to work Shabbos. And he describes that he goes to shul, the early minyan, the minyan we talked about. People ask me to confirm. What do I have to confirm? We all lived it. There are hundreds of thousands of people still alive who will tell you all over the Bronx, Manhattan, Brooklyn, there were 6:30 minyanim on Shabbos morning. People davened there, made kiddush, went home, changed their clothes, and went to work. You worked half a day on Saturday. We all saw it, experienced it. So he decides to go to work. He davens 6:30. Makes kiddush, changes his clothes, he's going to work, and when he reaches East Broadway, people are going to shul, the older generation, and he can swear that he sees his mother and father, he sees a bearded Jew with a woman head covered, European style, and he says, it's my parents, how can I go to work on Shabbos? And as they say, the rest is history. So, you see, the world changed. And Harry Fischel, I don't have to tell you, my wife wants to go look again. I once took her to the house he built. And I believe it's Central Park or Park Avenue. No, Park Avenue. I had the address, Park Avenue. Maybe Park Avenue and 82nd. And if you look at the house, two stories. And above the second story, one room for the next 30 floors till the roof, there's nothing there. No, did you ever see it? You know why? That was Harry Fischel's sukkah. And he wanted nothing to cover up his sukkah. He was willing to lose the rent, to make the apartments, endless apartments, one room less, that he should be able to build the sukkah on the second floor. Now, that's Harry Fischel. Now, so what happens is the Jews now are worried. We have to help our brethren in Europe. How can we help? They start raising funds. And when I say funds, hundreds of thousands, ultimately millions and millions of dollars. But here you come to the classic Jewish problem. Who raises the funds? What do you do with the funds? Look what's going on in the Knesset, how the parties bicker and barter back and forth where the money is going to go. the deals that are made. We Jews, unfortunately, since the Enlightenment, are not united. Maybe even before the Enlightenment, the Chassidish Litvaks. We're not united. So three different major organizations begin raising funds. First of all, the American Jewish Relief Committee. Those are the old-time German Jews. Affluent. Established. Jacob Schiff. Louis Marshall. Felix Warburg. American Jewish Relief Committee. Then you have the People's Relief Committee. Oh boy, People's, underline the word. Socialists, communists. These are not the wealthy Jews, German heavy money. These are the masses of people who believe in the people. And remember, the communist idea is germinating now. Socialism gives birth to communism, Bundism, the Jews. They're collecting money. And then you have the Frum Jews. Essentially, the East Europeans, our brethren, are being killed, are being tortured, are starving. The Central Relief Committee. Three different organizations. Competing to a small degree, because each one reaches a different clientele. How do you distribute? How do you not overlap? How do you see to it that the millions you raise get to Europe and don't wind up in procedural expenses? And my dear friends, in World War I, a miracle happened. All the Jews agreed to cooperate. And these three different elements, the American Jewish Relief, the Central Relief, the People's Relief, formed together. No, the Joint Distribution Committee, the JDC, which functions in tool today. And inevitably, their Rabbanim who work for the JDC, a positive attitude towards Torah. Over the last 100 years, the JDC has distributed billions of dollars for Torah institutions all over the world. Communist Russia, Eastern Europe, Palestine. A miracle of miracles. And I'll show you a connection right through this room and yours truly. There's a famous picture of all the big shots meeting together. You can find it in the Encyclopedia Judaica. It's probably online. JDC, all the Board of Trustees. And sitting Abenon, right up front, everyone, tremendous Derech Eretz, the representative par excellence of the Orthodox Jews, Central Relief, Rabbi Aaron Teitelbaum. Rabbi Aaron Teitelbaum, this is a Chassidish Jew, big Yichus, Teitelbaum family. Big Mizrahi leader, religious Zionists. What's the connection to this classroom? I taught his grandson. I inspired his grandson. I taught his granddaughter-in-law. I inspired his granddaughter. I brought them in Aliyah. His daughter, Rav Aaron Teitelbaum's daughter-in-law, Zichrona Levracha, was upset with me. At the end of her life, she said to me, "Oh, Rebbe, what you did, fabulous, that you brought the kids in Aliyah." You all know him. How many of you have gotten glasses at iWorld? No? Who owns iWorld? Who started it here? Ari Teitelbaum. Who's he named for? His grandfather, Harav Ari Teitelbaum, Aaron Teitelbaum. That's the Zeta. That's Ari. That's the Joint Distribution Committee. It is hard to believe, but a miracle happened, and Jews work together. Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Okay, I'll go further. I have to prepare myself. This is hard for me. It's very hard. The JDC. What did they do? What are we talking about? And here I want to share with you one of the greatest moments if you look back on the Rebbe's life. See, at times you do something and you don't realize the implications. Ari was my student, Sahava's wife, Glenda. I used to call her Glenda. She got mad at me. I told her, Al-Pi Din, according to the Ramban, I have to call you Glenda. It's the biggest compliment. Look up the Ramban. Machodesh Hazel Lechem Rosh Chodeshim. You know what the Ramban says. But, all right, she wants Sahava instead of Glenda. You can't fight with her. We'll leave the Ramban out of it. Yomo, time to do something in your life. So my students go and dream that because of my influence, there's going to be a chain of stores here, iWorld. And they influenced the whole scene of optometry here, raised it to a higher level. So the Rav, I told you, 1958, 56, I should say, the 8th anniversary of Israel, gives a talk. The Mizrahi pressured him, Rebbe, we want to hear from you, we want to hear from you. All right, he agreed to give a talk. Go and dream that that talk might have been the most important moment in the Rebbe's life. Understand, there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in Israel have studied that talk. So, let's shoot ahead to 73, 74. There was the Yom Kippur War. And it was a terrible period. We still don't know how we survived until today. I was living here already 5 years. I cannot tell you how many people I know who were killed in Tul, including two madrichim of BMT. How old was BMT? 5 years old. Two madrichim were killed. Endless people. I remember from my shul, the Kohen was killed. Ah, what? We don't know how we survived. It was a miracle. It's not the time to go into detail, but thank God we're here. Because of the Yom Kippur War, all the money was diverted to Israel. And the yeshivat, the Bat HaYeshivat, ran yeshivat in Israel. Fortune of money was not coming in. Yeshivat were bankrupt. Obligations, students, food. So, the Agudas HaRabbanim and the RCA saw the situation is desperate. They set up a meeting with the heads of the Joint Distribution Committee. Rav Moshe was on the committee, the Rav, but they all decided that the Rav should be the spokesman for the committee that was meeting with the JDC, because the Rav had a beautiful command of English, although it was slightly accented, but his English was second to none. Rav Moshe could speak English, but it didn't compare to the Rav. And the Rav agreed to be the spokesman. Years later, the Rav was being honored, the Rav was being introduced at the Rabbinical Council of America Annual Convention, 1979. And the person who ran the RCA, the Executive Vice President, who was a legendary figure, Rabbi Israel Klavan, I had the schut to know him, he taught members of his family, nephews, etc. He was the son of Rabbi Joshua Klaverman. Anyone here from the all right, you know who we're talking about. His brother was rabbi in Washington. What was his brother's name?
Hillel
Klaverman. Rabbi Hillel Klaverman. I taught his children, right? So Izzy Klaverman. Izzy Klaverman was a Talmudet of Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, Rabbi Revel. And these were a different level of Rabbanim. It's not like we turn out today. It was a different level altogether. Steeped in Yiret Shemayim, but tremendous common sense, seichel. So he told the following story. I'm quoting to you from the Rav, volume 1, page 263. And this is Izzy Klaverman speaking, not Aaron Rakefet. It's 1979, he's introducing Rebbe, introducing the Rav. If I may, I just want to reminisce on one story. The Rav will forgive me if I do. But to me it is the one that perhaps remains with me most vividly. This happened in late 73 or early 74, right after the Yom Kippur War, when all the monies were being channeled to the critical needs of Israel and support for important stuckers were drying up. The Vad HaYeshivat, the Yichud Yeshivat, came screaming, Gewalt, what are they going to do? Finally, they sent a delegation to us, the RCA, and we were fortunate in being able to help by arranging a meeting with the top brass of the Joint Distribution Committee about this issue. The Rosh HaMedabrim, when we went there, was the Rav. Reb Moshe Feinstein was also there, but it was the Rav who was the spokesman. I want to tell you, just as an illustration of the nature and the wisdom of the man, referring to the Rav, how he did this. Sitting there, he pulled out a small sheet of paper from his pocket and began to read. Gentlemen of the joint, who are gathered here, before I can speak to you and tell you what we want, I must pay back a debt of gratitude that I owe the joint for many years. This debt is over 50 years old. I have two memories from the First World War that I must share with you. They troubled my conscience because I never had the opportunity to say thank you. And now I must say thank you to you. Then he went on to describe in his inimitable fashion a scene of the children dancing with the Rebbe and singing, thank you, Uncle Joint. Thank you, Uncle Joint. It was right after World War I, and a shipment of cocoa had arrived for the Jews of Poland sent by the Joint. That day, a portion of the cocoa was distributed in the Cheder in Chaslovich. It was the first sweets they had been able to taste in years. The children drank the cocoa, and it meant so much to them that they sang and danced, thanking Uncle Joint for having sent it. A dankach fette joint. Then the Rav said, and imagine who's listening to this. Reformed Jews, conservative Jews, people that are so distant from Yiddishkeit, can be rabbis, but they're so distant, so distant. I say if someone knows what Yiddishkeit is, he'll never leave it, he'll kiss it with heart and soul. Then the Rav said, quote, I have to, this is unbelievable, I have to thank you for another thing. I went with my father to visit my father's brother. It's a very famous rabbi, Rav Elwell. I believe it was in Warsaw. Before, and this is the Rav speaking, it's not me. Before I could say Jackie Robinson, my father and my uncle were engaged in a deep controversy about the explanation of a difficult passage in the Gemara. My uncle turned to me and said, go next door, bring in the Gemara. I walked in and I saw in the bookcase something that I had never seen before. A new shas, a new set of Gemara. I never knew that a Gemara could be anything but a collection of tattered sheets. That is all we had during the whole period. Here, suddenly, I lovingly took out a Gemara that was brand new. I opened it up, and on the inside cover it said, Matana Mehajoint, a gift from the joint to the Jews of Poland. It seems that the joint had distributed newly printed sets of Talmud to the leading rabbis of Poland. I must thank you for these two gifts before I speak to you today. Imagine the Rav, these two stories. Izzy Klavan goes on, gentlemen, I was there. I saw it. The Rav didn't have to say anything else. The leaders of the joint fell over themselves, trying to help. What is it you want, Rabbi? What is your request? Anything you ask, we will do. I remember that the man who's currently president of the joint and then was vice president jumped up with a gold pen in his hands and began to take notes. What is your request? The Rav has the wisdom of knowing how to approach people. I learned so much from him by just observing his daily actions. This is the Sichat Chulin of the Torah sages, which our sages considered so important. And Rabbi Klavan quoted the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, Daf Yutet Amid Bet, Afilu Sichat Chulin Shon Talmidei Chachamim Tzricha Talmud. Wow, what a story. And you get a feeling, an appreciation, what the joint was, what they accomplished, what they did, and for the first time, everyone cooperated. To me, that description by Izzy Klavan of the Rav is classic. I don't think there's anything we have that equals it. It captures the Rav, it captures the moment, it captures the insight, it captures the genius, the Sichat Chulin of Talmidei Chachamim. Excuse me, and I'm Mudala Kadosh Baruch on a personal level that I was privileged to preserve it for eternity. Gentlemen, World War I changed everything. Changed the map. Changed Agud Tarabonim, changed the whole concept of responsibility, and from World War I, you follow in every convention of the Agudas Harabonim, the entire focus was on Europe, was on Palestine. America was only a secondary concept. What they did, what they accomplished, what they attempted to do is overwhelming. And Gurish Rabbanim, you'll see their decisions or their resolutions, it's an entire different ballpark. One of the most fascinating, already in World War I, is that every Rav, it's not just your own kehillah, but you're responsible to go, to travel, to speak, to raise funds, to spread the message, to inspire. There was an entirely different vista, an entirely different outlook. They were no longer self-centered, but they were concerned with what went on with Torah Jews and Jews in general throughout the entire world. Okay. One more second step to go. And we're preparing the stage for next week, which again is overwhelming. And it affects everyone in this room. It's beyond words what came out of it. But this is the way history works. This is the way Torah works. The Hashgacha Pratit is overwhelming. But I don't want you to be like Yomo and tell me, Lord, that God is going to take care of me and do everything for me. Hishtadlut. We have to act first. I told you, when I learned in Lakewood and they demanded, commanded, how can you go to college? You can't go to college, forbidden. And I would ask, well, how will I make a living? And the answer was, what, you lack bitachon? How will you make a living? There'll be a check in your mailbox every month. You just have to sit and learn Torah. All right. I don't know if that's a proper approach. All I can say is Rabbi Yisrael Salanta would not agree with that approach. So the Hashgacha Pratit here is overwhelming, but the Hishtadlut has to come as well.
One second.
After World War I, there's no question that people go back to their own camps, to their own involvement, their own interests. But the central relief is on the map. And what happens, this is what I want to set the stage for next Monday's Shayura, their concern for all that's going on in the Jewish world is overwhelming. In addition, the Joint Distribution Committee remains an active organization. It doesn't mean that everyone else totally stops their activities, but nevertheless, they distribute tens and tens of millions of dollars yearly, hundreds of millions. Today, it may be over $1 billion yearly. And the yeshiva division of the Joint remains active until this very day. If you understand, I remember when I came in Israel, I remember meeting Rabbi Dr. Aaron Greenbaum, he was a Talmud of Rav Moshe, a Talmud of Rabbi Revel. He was son-in-law of Rav Menachem Kasher, if I'm not mistaken. Check it out. He represented the Joint all over the world, and there was no end to what the Joint did. But here's what happens. So World War I comes to an end. And America, whenever you have a war, so after the war, you all know there's tremendous prosperity. Why is there tremendous prosperity? Because during the war, you can't manufacture. Everything is for the war effort. You don't have new cars. We're talking World War I. You don't have clothes. You don't have this. Everything was taken away. Clothes meant people became millionaires, making clothes for soldiers. Everything is war-oriented. After the war, this happened after World War II, too. They call it the post-World War boom. And after the war, wow, after World War II, for instance, suddenly nylon became available. Until then, it was discovered in the late 30s. And then, during the war, it was all used for war effort, whatever they needed nylon for, whatever it had to be manufactured. Now, after World War II, suddenly nylon is available. Wow, what an industry popped up. We became multimillionaires within a year or two, manufacturing nylon socks for women. Something so simple, which you couldn't get during the war. Same thing with World War I. America thrived. You go into the Roaring Twenties, right or wrong, it's called the Roaring Twenties. Not just because they danced and had music and jazz and whatnot, and then movies are coming down, Jolson, but the Roaring Twenties, there was money in Europe, which suffered during the World War I more than anyone else. That was the battlefield in post-World War I. Tremendous depression, tremendous lack of money, tremendous monetary difficulties, starvation. Communism took over Russia, and what went on in Russia on a religious level, I don't have to go into more detail, the Sixth Rebbe, the arrest, the Rebbe being exiled, being sentenced to exile, and then they revoke it and throw him out of the country. By the way, a good deal of the Rebbe's ability during the initial years to keep up Yiddishkeit in Russia was money from the Joint Distribution Committee. The JDC only stops later when they start outlawing, that's by the early 30s, they start outlawing any religious activity in Russia, even that which is permitted by the Constitution of Russia, but the Russian government, for whatever their reasons are, not only Jewish activity, all Jewish activity, Christian activity, everything is outlawed. Then the JD stopped for fear that the Russian government wouldn't let them engage in other activities in Russia where Jews were starving, nothing to do with religion, and they were pumping in money. And JDC today is active, their Jewish agency, Joint Distribution Committee, until today, the miracles that they do, and a good deal of it goes to from Jews. It has nothing to do with politics and socialism and communism and Yekes and East Europeans. It's to help Jews netto, net help for Jews, period. But now, and then you have the Israeli situation, what becomes Israel, the Palestinian situation. Following World War I, as I said, Zionism is on the map. There are now hundreds of thousands of Zionists. Mizrahi is on the map. Settlement in Palestine is picking up. This is now, you're going into the period of the Third Aliyah, which happens to be a massive Aliyah. It didn't have as much influence as the Second Aliyah. The Second Aliyah, approximately 1910, I believe they say 1910 to 1920, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. The Second Aliyah shaped the country. They were the ones that brought socialism and the Mapai and Ben Yitzchak and Ben Tzvi, Ben Tzvi and Ben Gurion, and they were the ones that basically shaped the country, and we struggle with it until today. I can't say we've had sea changes on the most elementary level in Israeli society, although we will ultimately achieve it, but they shaped the country. The Second Aliyah was much more massive, and now you have not just yeshiva in the Yeshiva Hayashan, but you have already the first ray of vision in the Yeshiva HaKadash. The greatest example, of course, is Yeshivat Hebron. This is revolutionary. You can't imagine what it was like. The Yeshiva Hayashan, this is the way yeshivas were in the 1800s, so they can continue in the 1900s. Hebron already was a new tomorrow, and all these institutions are having tremendous financial problems. And the Central Relief Committee undertakes to raise $1 million. Put it in today's terminology, what would it be worth today? Figure out. $1 million in 1923. 1924, what would $1 million be worth in today's money? And they learned this from World War I. We have to act, we have to do. The Agudas HaRabbanim, there's total responsibility. We are our brother's keepers. Yeshivas all over the world have to be helped. We have to put Torah on the map. We can't allow the vicissitudes of the end of World War I and the result of World War I to continue to cloud the picture. We must act. And then, for the first time, you have an effort that worthy of a movie, worthy of a documentary, and as I will show you next week, it's an effort that affects Torah Jewry, influences Torah Jewry, influences everyone in this room to a certain degree, that goes on until this very moment. And that's next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, the Central Relief Committee. And when I say Central Relief, the main people involved were the leaders of the Agudas HaRabbanim and what they did to help the yeshiva throughout the world, the 1924 rabbinical visit to America, Canada, and its implications. And this is a world unto itself. A lot of memoir literature has come out, and you'll see the implications that reach out to every last one of us sitting in this room and listening across the world. So if I can reiterate, what did we do today? Reb Lazer Silver touched upon him, the difference between Reb Lazer and the previous leaders of the Agudas HaRabbanim, the miracle that we now have Rabbanim who can speak English, although they're still partially from the old country and East Europeans and attitude and mentality and outlook, etc. But they're Americanizing. And World War I, the catalyst, what it does for Jewish appreciation, recognition, for your own self, for your own values, your own outlook. I am my brother's keeper. The miracle of the Joint Distribution Committee. Ari, Rabbi Aaron Teitelbaum. It's amazing. That's his grandson, Ari Teitelbaum. His son was Reb Simcha Teitelbaum. No, does anyone recognize the name? Reb Simcha Teitelbaum built the yeshiva in Kew Gardens Hills. Central Queens, the first principal, the organizer, the educator, the visionary, a man who put his life into it and died young, and some say the Akvas Nefesh of all that he did and having to fight. Who wanted yeshiva then? It wasn't like the environment of today or the milieu of today or the air of today. It was a different America. That's Rabbi Simcha Teitelbaum. He built Yeshiva of Central Queens. That's the big yeshiva right next to Young Israel of Kew Gardens Hills. And the Ari Teitelbaum is the son of Reb Simcha, the grandson of Reb Aaron. And with World War I ending and all the problems that develop afterwards, that's where the Central Relief comes to life again, and it undertakes a one-time-only project. But that one-time-only, as we'll show you next week, what it does from American Orthodoxy. It's a tremendous catalyst in bringing Torah to the United States. And ultimately, the Torah from the United States winds up right here in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, Ad Kan Hayom. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, Sunday's class is unbelievably important. I'm going to deal with cases out of Eastern Europe and Agunot and Mamzei Rut and how Rav Avadja, case after case, Rav Avadja is able to solve. It's amazing. If I want to see how Rav Avadja is accepted, but to me, it seems we have now solved 99% of problems that can come up with Agunot, and meaning Mamzei Rut. These are freebies that I've picked up, one I previously gave out, I believe. I've listened to them. I don't know. I have a lot of difficulty. If I were not frum and these people were trying to make me frum, I don't believe they could succeed. But each one of you entitled to your own opinion. To me, there's an overstress on Kabbalah, and they can describe the angels and Olam Haba, and they're too preoccupied with sex. I've never seen anything like it. I can't even repeat what goes on here. So if anyone's interested, this is all in English. Although I believe all of them are native Israelis functioning in Queens today, but it's all in English. This is for Rabbi Rubin when he comes back. This is Rabbi Riskin's paper. I gave out a copy, someone sent me another copy, wanted my opinion. Halacha l'maisa, I agree with part of it, I disagree with a great part of it, but I don't want to criticize Rabbi Riskin publicly. I'll tell you why. I know the great things he did in America in the 70s. I was living here already, but I'm well aware the 60s into the 70s, Rabbi Rubin did great things, Rabbi Rishkin did great things, I should say. I don't want to be critical, but I certainly don't agree with most of his stand vis-a-vis woman. This is Chabad, Rabbi Mordechai Lipska, two lessons that we can learn from the moon. Chabad is magnificent, as you will see. The Cape Town water crisis is unbelievable. People told me about this, and these are all the details that Cape Town refuses to use the Israeli desalinization process, which we are the leading one in the world, because it's made in Israel, so the people should rather go without water than use an Israeli system. This is an amazing article from the New York Times. You got to make a shechiyuno. Bermuda outlaws gay marriage less than a year after it became legal. So it shows you there's some people in the world who still think like human beings should think. This is interesting for the rabbis here. Orthodox rabbi survey shows moderate pay but few benefits, which takes me back to this lecture where I mentioned about the pension plan. I have to be honest, I taught in YU from 62 to 69 when I went in Aliyah. So from that pension plan, I get a few $1,000s a year. I can't believe it. Chinam ein kesef. That money that came out of my salary came in. I didn't teach, let's say, 64 began, so 64, 5 years. I know one rabbi who lost the ability already. It's a big problem we've spoken about in Chinuch. When you're over 70, how do you keep young? All right, I'm younger than all my students. That's a different story. But this rabbi evidently didn't keep young. So Rabbi Lamb, I think, retired him. It has to be Rabbi Lamb. Maybe Richard Joel, I don't know. And he was furious, and why you said, and they proved it, what's he upset about? The guy left within his pension plan was on to $1 million. See, and they had taught for YU for so many years. So very interesting. Now, this deals again with the women's issue that is haunting us. After new OU ruling, business as usual at Orthodox Women's Rabbinical Seminary, the Maharatz, Rabbi Weiss's seminary, business as usual. You can read the article, you'll see what we're talking about. Wait 1 second, what is this? Oh, this is part of Riskin's essay. Yeah, you can't build everything. You see, he builds upon Dayanut. Everyone's asking, what is Riskin training women to become Dayanut? So it's based upon a concept in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, Kiblu Alai, that if you accept, for instance, the example I gave you in class with Reb Leisa Silva, how do you have a Bore Yachid? There's no such thing. Bore Rut has to be three. Zabla, Zebore Lechaz, Berchalen, the two Borerim, pick a third. But if you agree, you can take one. Same thing if he's an Amoritz. But you agree, whatever he will say with common sense, you'll accept the name of it. You're obligated. Same thing with a woman. Right or wrong. Kiblu, Miriam Hanaviyah, Devorah Hanaviyah, Shofetet, Kiblu Aleihem. So if we agree to have women die or not, but then women, it's much more than money. It works very differently. This is an article from the New York Times about the evangelists who have backed Trump. They now have open door to the White House. And the article is very interesting because it deals with a very simple ethical problem. We have a president, Baruch Hashem, he's good for conservatives, he's good for Israel, but what about his own personal life? If you're an evangelist, don't you want the people you look up to lead a proper Christian life? And now you get involved. The President of the United States, does he lead a proper Christian life? What about the locker room talk, etc., etc.? So it's a very, very interesting article. I'll tell you, it's a shame the New York Times doesn't know what Israel is all about, doesn't know what Yiddishkeit is all about. Their articles are insightful. But to read the New York Times on a constant level and all their articles, you'll have so much heart failure, it's not worth it. They mamish have no concept of what Torah Hashem Tamima is, what Rapanama Yitzchak, there's a from Rabbi Asher Weiss, beautiful article here. Yeah, the man is an ongoing genius. My dear students, until we meet again in health and happiness, Besora Tova, Jeshuv Lechamot, Aleinu V'al Kol Yisrael, Das V'danya.